All right. This is not your grandma's Bible study.
Which I'm looking forward to.
This is not your grandma.
And I'm not your grandma.
I am Jill.
I'm Zach.
And we are giving this podcast thing a go. It's really weird talking to people who aren't listening. So that's fun. So we had gotten together and thought about putting together a podcast that had to do with a critical take on the biblical texts, but that wasn't super stuffy, kind of snooty, and it doesn't have a pastoral bent. So if you're here looking for like hot takes on how to be a pastor, I would not take my advice. I might have some hot takes, but they're probably not that hot. And you should not take them. Zach might have some more experience for all I know. But so sort of the idea behind this is to kind of take seriously the biblical text, use the skills that we've both gained through years of study, and to try to make the biblical texts more accessible, more approachable, but also take a scholarly approach to them. So tell you a little bit about me. I'm Jill, and I am a PhD candidate in New Testament studies at Bride Divinity School. I don't know if we can give our school name out. We can bleep it.
we can edit that in post.
Yeah, we can edit that in post, or you can, because I don't know how to do that. And yeah, so that's my credentials. How about you, Zach?
My name is Zach. I am a PhD candidate in Hebrew Bible here at Name Redacted. Yeah, just doing the PhD life and excited to talk about some interesting things in the Bible.
Hopefully. We think they're interesting.
We'll see.
And 10 other people at SBL, the Society of Biblical Literature, think so. So we decided to start with a passage in Mark, the Gospel of Mark, which is in the New Testament and therefore my specialty. So some of it, we're going to assume a little bit of biblical literacy here, that maybe you've heard of these books of the Bible at the very least. But we'll try to do our best to be clear on technical terms and, you know, be aware that not everybody has had 20 years of post-secondary school studying of biblical texts and scholastic scenarios.
Yeah.
So since it's New Testament, I'm taking point this week. When we do Hebrew Bible / Old Testament texts, Zach will be taking point on those predominantly, although we both are cross-trained to a certain extent and have plenty to say about the other's canon. So we're going to talk a little bit about the we're going to talk for the entirety of this podcast about however long this lasts today, about the death of John the Baptist, and that's found in Mark chapter 6, verses 14 through, I should know this, but, you know, I can only be expected to know so much, 29, 6, 14 through 29. And one of the things that I want to talk about in this passage, because there are lots of things that you could, is I want to talk about how Herod's power is on display in this passage, and that it's that you see the bigger system of how his power is validated, how his power is demonstrated, and how many different people contribute to that exercise of his power, and that it results in the death of John the Baptist. So, that being said, let's talk a little bit about the honor-shame culture of mm-hmm. the ancient Mediterranean, mm-hmm. Because that's, for, I would say, most people in Western societies, that's just not, honor and shame are not defined in the same ways that they were in the ancient Mediterranean cultures, and also they don't really affect our lives in the same way. Mm-hmm. I think there are some cultures that still highly value these. I would say the Japanese culture is probably one. Mm-hmm. Not that I have been there or know anything, but several of the people that I've met from Japan have real deep senses of what's honorable and what's not. So I don't want to say that these categories and these values aren't present elsewhere, but I just don't think that they're really common in the United States.
Not to the same extent.
Not in the same ways. Mm-hmm. So I think one of the biggest differences is that in the ancient Mediterranean cultures, there's a really collective sense of self. It's not just the individual I, it's me as a group, and the concept of kind of the self, I think, is, I mean, it's there to an extent, but it's also not really there. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the valuing of one's own personal choices over everybody else's in societies and individual rights and things like that are just kind of non-existent in the big picture of things. So honor and shame are not only just things that you have, that you think of yourself, but they're usually ascribed to you by somebody else, and they are limited goods, if you will. Mm. So for me to be honorable is for somebody else to be shamed.
Right.
Not everybody can be honorable, because then those categories lose their value. So this, the group that kind of judges you, there's several scholars that talk about this, but Ziba Cook is one of them, and she talks about the Ziba Cook. She talks about the Public Court of Reputation, or the PCR for short, is what I'm going to call it. So you have this concept of honor, which is sort of how you value yourself in your own eyes, but then you have this component of it that is based on the eyes of your social group or setting. And that social group and setting are really key components, because something that you think you're doing that's honorable, if everybody around you is like, no, it's not, then in this type of society, it's not honorable. Mm. That's not the honorable thing to do. Mm-hmm. In our individualistic society, sometimes we would still view that as more honorable, because you're going against whatever, but you're swimming upstream,
right,
or
right,
swimming against the current or whatever. So, so these public courts of reputation are really crucial for the acquisition and bestowal of honor. And Ziba Crook says that, Bruce Molina, who's a social scientist who does a lot of work in New Testament studies, he argues that public praise can give you life, whereas public ridicule can kill you. And so these are really serious, weighted categories that I think are crucial for understanding what's happening in this particular passage. And so when you... Do I need to say anything more about honor and shame, or do you think I've kind of animal to death?
No, I think it's good. I think the only thing that might be good to just spend a second on is just that I think shame, the language honor, I don't think we have a really good concept of that in the United States, at least from the backgrounds and contexts mm-hmm. that I've grown up in. But I think shame has a very wide range of meaning, and think in the sense of... the ways in which that is tied to morality, but not, especially because we're talking, you know, in the sense that people are probably Christian or Christian adjacent in listening to this. Uh-huh. And so shame, like you just said, that shame in the ancient world, especially in the Mediterranean, like could get you killed.
Yeah.
Whereas shame is much more internalized shame, in a way. Now.
I think for us, shame is guilt.
Yeah.
Like if I do something bad that I'm ashamed of, what that means is I feel guilty about mm-hmm. having done it mm-hmm. for whatever reason. And that's not really the case in the ancient Mediterranean. You can be a shamed person and there's no guilt associated with that. For instance, every slave in the ancient world was a shamed person mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. and there is no guilt
right.
in that social status in terms of the emotion that we associate with guilt. And so it has to do with sort of kind of where you are in the hierarchy and how much power you have to wield mm-hmm. And how you wield that power.
Would you say that honor shame is kind of almost like in antiquity is more of like a marking system in the sense of you're marked as honorable, you're mm-hmm. marked as shamed, rather than I think, again, because of how individualized our society is, ideas like honor and shame are almost completely internalized, whereas actually it's almost the opposite in antiquity. It's an externalized reality that everybody knows about and it affects your life.
Yeah. Well, I think, so we get this concept of honor in talking about how, you know, like, honor is what you do when you're alone, like the quality of your character. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, you know, when nobody's around, how do you treat people? You know, how do you treat, you know, you're the server at your restaurant or whatever. Like, those are indicators of how honorable of a person, and we kind of tie that up with, like, the quality of your character. Mm-hmm. And in antiquity, honor is a performed act. Mm. Like, you're not, they don't care what you're doing behind closed doors. Nobody can see that because you have to have the public court of reputation judging your actions.
Right.
So it is a performed thing. Mm-hmm. And so you need to behave certain ways, and they will be judged as honorable or shameful. And it doesn't have anything to do with how you particularly feel about those actions. I mean, thinking about, like, whenever military leaders kill themselves when they lose a battle, mm-hmm. and that, like, that noble suicide concept is an honorable act in those circumstances. It doesn't matter whether or not that person feels like killing themselves in that moment. The honorable thing to do is fall on your own sword.
Mm-hmm.
So disentangling those notions of honor and shame from character, in the way we think of character, mm-hmm. and the way we think of guilt in our society, and really putting those in the context of they're performative, and they really are based on others' perception of you and how they're going to judge what you've done. So, that being said, let's look at the scene in general. So, this passage about John the Baptist's beheading, it's just kind of spliced right into the middle of the mission of Jesus' disciples. So Jesus has commissioned his 12 disciples to go out and, you know, kind of extend his ministry. He's been healing the sick, he's been exorcising demons, you know, those kinds of things, and he's commissioned his 12 to go out and do that for him, in chapter 6, verses 7 through 13. And then you have this sort of interruption of the John the Baptist narrative. And then immediately following it, we get a notice that the disciples have returned to Jesus, and the mission is completed. So it's kind of interrupting, but it's also kind of on point. There's a scholar that I should have written these names down better. It probably is Davies and Allison. Let's just be honest.
Let's just assume
for the sake of argument, it's always Davies and Allison who have something to say about this. But that John's initial ministry is tied intimately with Jesus, the start of Jesus's ministry. So John's preaching in the wilderness, Jesus gets baptized by John, Jesus goes out. So then it actually does kind of fit that another story about John would be tied to an extension of Jesus' ministry.
Mm-hmm.
So the death of John corresponds with the going out of the 12. So that's one explanation, and I don't think it's a bad explanation for why the story's in here. The thing that's more interesting about the story to me than its placement is how drawn out it is.
Mm-hmm.
If you've never read the Gospel of Mark, it's pretty short and it's really rapid paced. It's sort of like the Cliff's Note version of Matthew. You get a couple of sentences moving on. There's a lot of the word immediately as a transitional word between scenes. And so the gospel has this sense of, like, moving rapidly towards Jesus's crucifixion. But this passage is really drawn out. Oh, and it wasn't Davies and Allison. I just found it. It's Lamar Williamson.
Aww.
Never would have gotten there on my own. Glad I wrote it down somewhere. So the fact that this story is really drawn out and there's a lot going on in it, I think merits some attention as to why the author of Mark thinks that this story couldn't just be, like, a side note. Also, John the Baptist was beheaded by Herod. Moving on. Because he could have done that, and he didn't. So So I really hold that with this honor and shame culture, the drawing out of the story, what we're supposed to see is that there are these webs of power that are being played out, and that a lot of people are responsible for the death of John the Baptist. Because one of my big problems with how this passage gets interpreted a lot of the times is that Herodias, Herod's wife, she gets blamed for the whole thing. It's mm-hmm. her fault. And I think a lot of that's rooted in misogyny.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And the text does say she's the one who says out loud, get his head on a platter. But I think that that's too simplistic. I do think she bears some responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
But she's not the only one. And that's what I think really putting together these honor and shame pieces with it kind of brings us at, that there are several people that are responsible, and not the least of which are the people who are just in the room, kind
right.
of letting it happen.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So Herod marries Herodias. So let's talk about why John the Baptist is arrested in the first place and why the Herods have beef with him. I don't know if people say have beef anymore.
Why not? Go for it.
Sure. I'm 420 years old. So Herod married Herodias, and Herodias, prior to marrying Herod, was married to Herod's brother Philip.
Okay.
So this is some Days of Our Lives nonsense.
Biblical edition.
Days of Our Lives, biblical edition. We need to take a minute to talk about the fact that her name is Herodias and she's married to Herod, and why? Like, I just want to know why. Why? Are they related? Like, I just, it's too complicated. I feel like it's almost lazy storytelling. I get that they were real people, but come on, just spice it up.
Mark, come on.
Get together, Mark. Learn to write a story. Holler. So anyway, Herod married Herodias after Herodias was married to Herod's brother, Philip.
Mm-hmm.
So then John gets wind of this, and he criticizes, as prophets are wont to do.
Of course.
Criticizing the powers that be, calling the marriage unlawful. And so there's a text back in Leviticus 18 that this is probably referencing. Leviticus is in the very beginning of your Bible, for those of you who
following along at home.
Haven't ever heard of the book of the Leviticus, because it doesn't get a whole lot of preaching play. The verse in question says, you shall not uncover the nakedness of your brother's wife. It is your brother's nakedness. Mm. It's pretty much an accusation of incest, essentially,
yeah.
even though she's not blood related to him, but it is still unlawful, and John is very, very vocal about his distaste for this this union. So Herodias got real upset, and she really hated John because of these accusations, and she wanted him dead. But Herod was afraid to kill him and imprisoned him instead. So it's interesting because Herod, in verse 20, in Mark 6:20, it says that Herod feared John and that he knew that he was a righteous and holy man, and so he kept him safe. He had some really interesting feelings towards John the Baptist. He went out of his way to protect him from mm-hmm. Herodias's anger. So it was sort of the marital compromise of how do we deal with this guy? You want him dead. I'm really scared of him. Let's put him in jail instead.
Close enough.
Yeah. So I think that it's this dynamic between Herodias' decided hatred for John the Baptist mm-hmm. and Herod's ambiguous fear of John the Baptist that really becomes the threat to Herod's honor at this dinner party. So the dinner party itself. Verse 6:21, Herod throws himself a birthday dinner.
As kings do.
As we've all done. Who among us?
Who hasn't?
Has not had to throw their own birthday party because their friends suck. Been there. They all showed up for the free baked potatoes.
Obviously. I'd show up.
Listen, baked potato is delicious. And it was free. And I did get a really good CD out of that birthday party, but whatever. So I'm not bitter. I'm not bitter, people, friends of mine.
It's a story for another time.
It's a story for my therapist. So Herod throws himself a birthday dinner, and he invites all of the elite of Galilee to attend this dinner. And the word in Greek that is used here at verse 6:22 is those who were dining with him, or those who were feasting together with him. And it's that "with him" part that I think is really crucial to what the story is trying to convey, and we'll get back to that. So these elite are high officials, military commanders, and just other wealthy elites of this region. And so this group, they don't really participate in a lot of the action, but they do become really powerful players as the narrative drama unfolds. And in my opinion, I think they're some of the most pivotal characters in this scene for ensuring that John the Baptist is killed. So then we get to the infamous dance of Herod's daughter, sometimes thought of to be Salome. So she's a really interesting character. She's not named in Mark. So Salome is an imported name. But I think that Herodias did have a daughter named Salome, or maybe Herod did. But the age ranges are weird. So it's hard to chronologically make sense of her being Salome, being this story, but there's no other record of them of either one of them having another daughter that's named. So make of that what you will. It's either made up or it's twisted around or whatever. Something the point like is not whether it actually happened or not. I feel like that needs to be said.
Yes, that's a good point.
The point is not, is this, you know, historical fact in the way that we think of history, but there's a bigger agenda, if you will, that Mark has, which is that we don't like the Herods, and so we're going to make them look as bad as we can. And that is really true of pretty much anybody who's writing about the Herods at this time. They don't really like this family.
Nobody likes them.
They're real D-bags. So so she's an interesting character. So she's the subject of 9 verbs in this story, and that's more than any of the characters in the verses from 22 to 29, sort of the meat action of the story. Sharon Bettsworth, she was one of my grad school professors, and she's brilliant. She reads this passage, and she notes that it's the daughter's actions of coming in, dancing, going out, asking, coming in again, and speaking, which propel the story forward, and they are the catalyst for the death of John the Baptist. So she's the active character in all of this, sort of dictating what's going to happen. But really interesting for a biblical text is that she's not acted on in any way by the other characters. Nobody's coercing her to do anything. Nobody's making her do anything, textually speaking, anyway. I mean, she probably didn't. Mm-hmm. If she was a 14-year-old girl, she probably didn't really have a choice if she was going to go and dance for these men or not.
Yeah.
But the way the story spells it all out, she's sort of an autonomous figure, which for a woman in antiquity and a child in antiquity, like, those are just, I mean, unheard of. That's, you just don't get that very often. Usually women are the object of a male's actions in these texts, and so to have a woman who's really spearheading this whole chain of events, even if they're really crappy chain of events, such a weird, like, it's so hard to not be like excited that a woman's getting like getting some airtime, and then, oh, but she's getting airtime to murder a prophet. Awesome. So, her presence at this banquet historically is really, really unlikely. So the author of Mark uses her and her dancing to create an opportunity for Herod's, as we'll find out, ironic display of power. the notion that a proper woman would be at present at this male banquet is just, I mean, it's intended to sort of make the Herods look even worse than they would. It would be one thing to have, you know, a courtesan or a party girl come in and perform for these men. She's a shamed woman.
Right.
That is her proper place in society. But to have the king's daughter come in and dance is really, it's really intended to be a way of shaming this family even more. So her dance isn't described, but that has not
stopped people.
That does not stop people from imagining. The dance is often just thought of to be very, very sexual.
Sure.
Which I think is possible. I would say that if the author of Mark really is putting her in this room to shame the family, he probably does have that in mind to an extent.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, the fact that we jump to immediately a woman can only be in a room because she's a sexual object is a problem, not just in antiquity, but in our current society. Let's get it together, world. So her dance isn't described, and we're not going to talk much about it. Just know that she's fodder for all kinds of artistic depictions. And whatever the dance was like, however it worked out, whether it was sort of an innocent, like, look at this play I'm putting on for you, Dad, like every five-year-old has ever done, or if it was intended to be a little bit more sexual and erotic, Herod and his guests were happy with it. So mm-hmm. make of that what you will. She satisfied what they needed in entertainment for that evening.
Mm-hmm.
But after this point, what's really interesting is after her dance, the way that these characters are talked about shifts dramatically. So Herod, between verses 14 and the beginning of verse 22, is named explicitly seven times as Herod, and moving forward, he's only referred to as the king. Herodias, who was named three times prior, now becomes the mother, and the unnamed daughter is now referred to as just the girl. And then the guests of the banquet are referred to as initially those who were feasting together, kind of with him. They become simply those who were feasting. So the together or the with him aspect of it is in a case. So this seems to be, in my opinion, kind of indicating a degree of separation between Herod and his guests, and making it more about tropes, I think, than a historical event. And I say that because these designations recall the Greek version of Esther. So there are two versions of Esther. There's the one in the Hebrew Bible / Old Testament. I'm just going to call it Hebrew Bible because it belonged to the Jews before the Christians got a hold of it. So if you call it the Old Testament, so be it. So the Hebrew Bible version is, you guessed it, in Hebrew.
Turns out. It's in Hebrew.
In Hebrew. Oh my gosh. So I was listening to this. I tried listening to this podcast on cults. This is a total sidebar. And they were talking about how they're talking about the cult in Elohim City, which is in Northeast Oklahoma. It's near where I grew up.
Uh-huh.
And it's loosely a cult, but it's sort of like this white nationalist, whatever.
Okay.
And Timothy McVeigh was loosely connected with it. That's why they're talking about it. Anyway, they really rely heavily on apocalyptic texts. And so the people who were talking about it were talking about how Revelation's in Greek and then that Daniel's in Hebrew, but some of it's in Aramaic. And one of the girls was like, what's Aramaic like? And they ended up just comparing it to Spanglish, that it's just a combination of Hebrew and Greek. And I was like, I can't listen to this podcast.
Oh, no. You can't say that. It's not. It's not at all.
It's not. Aramaic is not Greek in any capacity. They are not even in the same language family. Feel like that needs to be said in case the people from that particular podcast are listening. I've been needing to get that off my chest for a while. So anyway, Hebrew Esther and then Greek Esther, and there are some slight changes to the story and some additions.
Mm-hmm.
But in Esther, and for those of you who aren't familiar with the story, Artaxerxes is the king. He has a big party. Mm-hmm. He wants his wife to come in, Vashti. She's like, not going to happen. He kicks her out, and then he needs to find a new queen.
Mm-hmm.
Esther wins the lottery, if you will, to be the queen. And then she ends up being put in a really great position to save her people because one of Artaxerxes' advisors has it out for the Jewish people, wants to kill them, and has gotten the king to sign off on stuff that would make that happen. Esther finds out about it and intervenes. So Artaxerxes thrice makes a similar oath to that of Herod, who also makes his oath a couple of times, that, you know, he'll do whatever Esther wants. Mm-hmm. And so we've got this sort of comparison between Artaxerxes and Herod. And Artaxerxes ends up, you know, doing what Esther wants, and she uses her request to bring freedom to the Jewish people. Whereas Herod, who's sort of responding rashly out of his response to his pleasure, tells his daughter, "Request for yourself of me that which you want, and I will give it to you. Whatever you ask of me, I will give you, as much as half of my kingdom." And so the daughter's request, contrary to Esther's, actually results in the death of a prophet of God. Mm. So the Herods are sort of set up as an anti-type to Artaxerxes. Mm. In the use of this language of the king, the girl, the mother, things like that, this sort of trope-like way. Mm-hmm. But what's really interesting, I think, is that Herod doesn't really actually have any power to divide up his kingdom. As it turns out, it's a very ironic display of power. So he's identified as a king, but technically he was a tetrarch. He was appointed by Rome over the region of Galilee. He did not have really a say in the limits of his domain. His Roman overlords, if you will, make those decisions. So as a tetrarch, he didn't have any authority to subdivide this kingdom. So I don't know what he was thinking. It was rash. It was not thought out. It was, you know, caught up in the moment. So, you know, in contrast to Artaxerxes, who could deliver on whatever promise and does that he ends up making to Esther, Herod really cannot deliver as much as his oath might require of him. Because if she was like, yeah, I want half of your kingdom, like, he can't do that. So he's put himself in a really precarious position in regards to his own honor and shame, mm-hmm. because if she asks for something he cannot give, it is going to be a shaming moment for him. Mm. So, should we talk about oaths for a minute?
Yeah, let's talk about oaths. Fun.
I like oaths.
Oaths.
So oaths are a matter of great solemnity in the biblical texts. And rash oaths are often made at someone else's expense. So we'll talk about a couple of other rash oaths that happen in the Hebrew Bible so that maybe you can chime in a little bit. So the first one is in the book of Judges, chapter 11, we have the story of Jephthah. He's in a battle. He really wants to win against the Ammonites, and he promises God that if God will just give him this military victory, then whatever in exchange, he will sacrifice who or whatever first greets him when he gets home, which is just a stupid oath. I feel like he could have been more specific. Like, instead of it just being random, he could have been like, whatever animal first approaches me.
Not whatever.
Not who or whatever. Because as it turns out, he wins this military situation, and he gets home only to be greeted by his only daughter, his only child.
Womp.
And so the assumption of the text, although it's not narrated, is that this oath then results in him having to sacrifice his daughter. There's debates. It's not narrated in the text, so maybe it didn't happen. But he does get praised in Hebrews.
Yeah.
For being, you know, a man of faith. And I just think that that's crazy. But I didn't write it. So then the other passage is in 1 Samuel chapter 14, verses 24 to 46. And this is about King Saul's rash oath. Was he king at this point? Yeah, because he has Jonathan.
Yep, he was king.
Okay, so he makes this, for whatever reason, decision that he's going to forbid all of his soldiers from eating until after his vengeance against his enemies has been satisfied. Men. That's dumb.
Don't do that.
You don't have to withhold food just because you're angry. Like, take note, world leaders. I feel like take note, Venezuela.
Take note, Everyone.
Everyone. Like
everywhere.
People can eat and you can be angry. They're not like mutually exclusive options. So anyway, so he forbids his soldiers from eating until after his vengeance against his enemies has been satisfied. Such a friggin' king thing to do. But his son Jonathan, unfortunately just didn't hear this oath and ate some honey, which I get is technically food, but it's not food. So I feel like Jonathan could have argued this. But
honey is not food.
So Saul goes to kill Jonathan.
Yep.
And Saul's soldiers then intervene, and they provide a ransom for Jonathan's life. So you've got Herod being juxtaposed to Artaxerxes, who is sort of a good king whose oath results in the redemption of the Jewish people. But he's being aligned with these two other impulsive oath makers in Jephthah, who seems to have to sacrifice his daughter, and Saul, who was at the ready to do so but was stopped by the other soldiers. So I think it's kind of interesting that these oaths are really binding. They to just kind of renege on them is, I mean, it's a dishonorable thing to do. It's a shameful thing to do. Got to follow through. So, so we'll talk a little bit more about the Saul Jonathan stuff a little bit later. But I think just as a teaser, noting that those other soldiers served as a PCR to stop Saul, who decided in that moment the more honorable thing to do was let Jonathan live rather than follow through on the oath. So yeah. All right. Any comments or?
Yeah, I was looking at this and it's actually interesting, especially the way that you're talking about the lead up to this, that oaths, especially in the Hebrew Bible, are essentially self-curses, like the way that they function. And so to the extent that they actually only usually show up in the curse form. And they're conditional and all of that rolled together. So it is really interesting that, you know, in Jephthah's case, you've got a guy who probably knows, like, so backing up for a second, the oath had no legal ramifications with it. So there wasn't anything in written down saying, like, if you violate an oath. I mean, there were sanctions and there's stuff that you should do if you basically broke your oath and you hope to survive breaking your oath. But the oath was made before God. And so God was the one who meted it out. And there's some fun imagery in Zechariah about, I didn't even realize this, there's a flying scroll that apparently comes after people who are guilty of perjury of their oath.
Flying scroll.
Flying death scroll that's going to come after you.
That is amazing.
So, but anyway.
Nobody can say that the Bible is boring. We got flying scrolls.
Flying death scrolls. But the thing with like with Jephthah and with Saul is that, so they're making this oath, it's a self-curse conditionally made before God, but knowing that it's such a precarious thing to do in that situation too, because, I mean, I've read some stuff with some scholarship that Jephthah, in making that oath, knew in some ways who, because of the customs and everything else, like he knew that his daughter would probably be the first one out the door. You know, and the fact that Saul makes this really quick, rash oath, despite the fact that they've been fighting the Philistines for some time at that point, going, you're going to say an oath that is that binding and that has that much repercussion at the same time as denying your soldiers the one thing they need to keep fighting.
And so, he didn't do a head count to make sure that his own son was present.
Where's Jonathan?
Like, all right, there were 12 of y'all. I only see 11. What's Jonathan doing? He should hear this too. Like,
it's, yeah,
poor
it's,
leadership.
It's, but the thing about it too is, I think another point that's good to mention is that even though we don't, like in our context today in 2019 in the United States, like we don't do oaths. I don't swear oaths to people. The only time you're going to swear an oath is if you get called, you know, to the witness stand in a court.
To testify or when you get married.
Yeah, there's some, those very few moments where you have something what we would call an oath. But actually, in the context of the ancient Near East, I mean, oaths were super common.
Yeah.
I mean, they just were from the mundane thing, like, I'm going to pay you back, basically, to, you know, these really extraordinary things. And even, actually, if you look at the sanction, the like consequences for Israel's covenant with God actually has oath-like sanctions to it in Leviticus and Deuteronomy. And so very common things. So I think we, as readers from very removed and different culture, different time, I think it's easy to see these oaths and go, oh, these are these cryptic, weird curse formulas. And it's like, no, that was just part of life.
Yeah.
Like that. So it's, on the one hand, strange that these figures like Jephthah and Saul would make these crazy, really bad idea oaths. But at the same time, that was so baked into how they did stuff
yeah.
that it wasn't, it's also not necessarily something that's totally out of the blue that makes no sense that they did
it. Yeah, I think maybe we could relate to, so like when you're telling a story, people are like, that didn't happen. You're like, swear to God. And we just sort of casually throw it out.
Yeah.
But that's kind of baked into our vernacular
mm-hmm.
that we say it without really even thinking about what we've said.
Mm-hmm.
But would imagine if mm-hmm. when you said swear to God, you were bound by that and there were consequences if you were wrong.
Yeah.
I mean, that's sort of where we're at. And I think that that notion that it being complicated and being almost they're self-cursing
mm-hmm.
more often than not is even demonstrated in the New Testament. I mean, Jesus explicitly in Matthew 5 in the Sermon on the Mount, he forbids making oaths of any sort. And he says,
right.
just let your yes be yes and your no be no.
Mm-hmm.
Like, don't bring the Almighty into this.
Basically,
because
yeah.
it never works out well. He doesn't say that. I'm definitely glossing the text there. But then we also have James 5:12 in the New Testament that makes the same prohibition about don't make oaths. Like, that's not a new Christian thing. I think it was just a recognition
mm-hmm.
that they are so powerful
mm-hmm.
and they carry so much weight that it is better to not make them and just do what you say you're going to do
yep.
than to put on yourself consequences that you may not be able to actually live up to, or that would really suck if you had to follow through on them.
Yeah.
But Mark, interestingly, there are two other instances of oath making in Mark, even though Mark doesn't really make a prohibition against oaths. He kind of gets around that in a way. So we've got this passage that we're talking about now. Sorry, not two other instances, two instances. So the passage where Herod's making this really rash oath that ends up with the death of John the Baptist. And then later in chapter 14, Peter makes an oath that he does not know Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, I mean, it's a lie, outright lie. He does know Jesus. Read the 14 chapters prior to that. But I think what you can kind of see, even though it's not explicitly forbidden in Mark's gospel, but that these two examples of men making oaths are intimately tied to the deaths of holy men, that maybe you shouldn't do it because the consequences are big.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, granted, Peter's oath isn't why Jesus died, but it's in connection to it, and it's a betrayal of Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't know. I just think that that's – I think it's interesting that when we do have stories of oath making, it tends to be rash. It tends to result in somebody's death. Somebody has to die.
Mm-hmm.
But that we also have this awareness even at the time of people being like, don't do it. Like, don't make these oaths. Like, don't you recognize that this is a bad plan?
You're risking a lot to do
yeah.
this.
Yeah. So this oath is, I think, is just really interesting. And it's a binding thing. It's not just like Herod could be like, no, that's not what I meant. Like,
people
were listening. He promised some big stuff, and that oath made him vulnerable.
Mm-hmm.
So after he tells the girl, you know, I'll give you whatever you want up to half my kingdom, which I actually can't give you, but so don't ask for it. Maybe she's unsure of her power, or maybe she doesn't really know what she would want. Like, she's never been given an opportunity this big. So she goes to consult with her mother, Herodias, and asks her, what will I ask? Like, what? He's offering me a lot of things, Mom. What should I get?
what should I choose?
And so she... the mother, I think, maybe exploits this relationship.
Mm-hmm.
Sharon Bettsworth argues that she exploits the relationship to satisfy her own grudges. And so in that way, Herodias is responsible to an extent. She says the head of John the Baptizer is what she tells her daughter. And so the thing I want to point out, yes, Herodias bears some responsibility for this, but she does not command her daughter. The verb forms are not actually there isn't a verb form. It's just, it's not a direct command to her daughter, like, you have to ask this because I said so. So the daughter still maintains a sense of autonomy around this decision. She's just been given the suggestion of, like, how about John the Baptizer's head? Then there's this kind of account of John's imprisonment, and then the story again at 6:25 really picks up the pace again, like we're typical, like it's typical for the Markan narrative. So we get immediately she went in with haste to the king. She is impatient and commanding in her requests. She says, "I want right now the head of John the Baptizer." So she's really, her actions, her language are really propelling the story forward and picking up the pace again of what Mark is really used to. So she does make the request for John the Baptist's head, but then she kind of adds her own spin to it and adds on a platter. So the word in Greek is panax, and it means like a flatboard. And it refers to a serving dish customarily used at feasts. So when she goes back in and requests John the Baptist's head, she's asking for it to be presented as if it is one of the courses of the dinner.
Nice.
So grotesque. which is why in a lot of art pieces around this, you might see, there's one piece I'm thinking in particular where it's Herodias holding John the Baptist's head, but she's got like a serving platter in one hand and his head over it. Mm-hmm. And so that notion that he's part of the dinner is picked up on, and it's really gruesome, and man, that girl is twisted. So after she makes this request at 6:26, verse 6:26, we see Herod divided again. So prior he was divided about killing John the Baptist, so he imprisoned him instead. But the girl's request causes the king to be, quote, deeply grieved. Mm. And this verb is really, really interesting to me because, so the word is perilupos. Mm. So he's deeply grieved, perilupos, on account of his oaths and because of the ones feasting, he did not want to refuse her. So this deeply grieved word conveys a really strong emotion. And the only other time that it's used in the gospel of Mark is concerning Jesus in Gethsemane. Mm. And so is Mark the one that talks about Jesus sweating blood?
Mm. You're asking the wrong set of the candidate question.
Oh, my goodness. Sorry. So regardless, Gethsemane is the account of Jesus right before he is going to be crucified. He knows that he's being betrayed. He's waiting for the soldiers to come and take him. He's praying in the Garden of Gethsemane, and he's deeply grieved, as one might be mm-hmm. when one knows one's about to meet their fate in the most cruel way possible, yeah. that it's a crucifixion that's awaiting. Mm-hmm. So did you find it, was it?
It's in Luke.
Oh, it's Luke. Okay. Luke has Jesus was so stressed out, he was sweating blood. Mm-hmm. That's not in Mark. Don't import it. They are two different stories.
Don't harmonize.
But don't harmonize.
Don't harmonize. Don't,
unless you're in a quartet.
Then harmonize.
Then do it well. It's the only reason you should be in a quartet is if you can harmonize well. So you can imagine the kind of stress then that's being conveyed by this word. If Herod's grief over having to follow through on his oath is matched with Jesus' grief of knowing he's going to his death. So, mm-hmm. So there's some weight there, but I think this goes back to the point of like honor and shame have nothing to do with how you feel.
Right.
Because for Herod to do what is honorable is for him to swallow that, that perilupos grief that he has. And it doesn't get to have a say mm-hmm. In what happens next. So, I kind of argue that at this point, Herod's now he said earlier that he's afraid of John, but I think that at this point, he's being forced to decide who he's more afraid of. Is right. he more afraid of John or more afraid of his dinner guests, his public court of reputation? Mm-hmm. So to kind of put this in perspective, there's this really great essay by George Orwell that's called Shooting the Elephant. So Orwell was a sub-inspector of police in colonial Burma. And so he was called upon, so he's a British officer colonizing in Burma, and he was called upon to deal with this elephant that was in heat, and it was wreaking havoc. And this is a true story. So when he was when this armed Orwell finally finds the elephant, it was behaving peacefully. It was no longer threatening. There really was no reason to be afraid of this elephant at this point. It was fine. But he says that with over 2,000 of the locals watching him, he realized that he was going to have to shoot the elephant anyway. Right. And so Orwell says in his essay, "The people expected it of me, and I had got to do it. I could feel their 2,000 wills pressing me forward irresistibly." So James Scott is an anthropologist, and he has a book that's called Hidden Transcripts. Oh my gosh, Dominations in the Arts of Resistance. And he argues that subjugated people groups and oppressed people groups have all kinds of means available to them to resist that are not always violent. They can be, but little things like evading taxes or, you know, anonymous catcalling on the street or, you know, things like that that give them a release of being able to speak back to power, but also are sort of can be self-protective. And then when things escalate too far, there might be outbreaks of violent resistance, but that's never the first thing that happens. There's always lots and lots of things going forward. So Scott makes, around this Orwell story, he makes a really important and relevant point that the necessary posing of the dominant derives not from weakness, but from the ideas behind the rule, the kinds of claims they make to legitimacy. Actions by elites that publicly contradict the basis of a claim to power are threatening. So Orwell here, as an official of the colonizing nation, was a representative of the system that made certain claims to justify their dominance. And so his decision regarding the fate of the elephant would result in either reinforcing that claim or in ridicule. So Orwell writes, and I think this really summarizes the precariousness of power, which is not to make us feel sorry for them. Like, I'm not trying to make you sympathize with Herod or anything like that, but to recognize that it's complex is that Orwell writes, "My whole life, every white man's life in the East, was one long struggle not to be laughed at." So looking back at the story of Saul and Jonathan we talked about earlier, so Saul is prepared to fulfill the requirements of his oath. He's willing to kill Jonathan. But fortunately for Jonathan, the other soldiers intervened and they don't allow Saul to kill him. So the soldiers function in this situation, like I said earlier, as a sort of PCR because they recognize Jonathan's military value. That's what they talk about. Maybe they also liked him, but that's not why he gets to live. So in this case, the group essentially reassesses what's most honorable in the situation. So Saul, kind of comparing it to the Orwell story, so Saul stands at the ready to kill his own elephant, his Jonathan, his son. But the locals, his soldiers, they don't require the death of the elephant. And so the text is pretty silent about why Saul decided not to follow through on his oath, but Jonathan didn't die. He was ransomed. So I argue that I think that Saul's PCR determined Jonathan's fate, not Saul's oath. And I think that's the power of these people sitting by and watching is to determine what's the honorable way to proceed with this oath. So back to Herod, we've got a similar situation here. Herod's elephant is John, if you will, and his locals, the 2,000 wills pressing him forward, are his dinner guests. So Herod has promised this girl up to half his kingdom, though it's not technically his to give. It is a claim to imagined power and authority, and it's a claim he makes publicly. So fortunately, unfortunately for John, fortunately for Herod, the girl requests something that he can deliver, and that's John's head on a platter. And so you read commentaries on this, and lots of interpreters want to talk about Herod as being weak, as into giving into the whims of these women, to, you know, betraying his own ancestral heritage. And I don't think that's what's happening here. I think that he really is conforming to the ideas that are legitimating his authority here. And so Herod, acting in a manner contradictory to his oath, deciding in that moment, no, anything but that is a threat to his power and to his place in that system. And so he's got this PCR that's present to assess and to ascribe his honor. If it had just been his daughter danced for him, promised it, nobody heard the oath, he probably could have backed out on things because as a man, innately, he's more honorable than a child, a female child. So it's the presence of these others dining together with him that really, I think, seals the fate of John the Baptist, because they, by their passivity, agree that the honorable thing to do is to follow through on this oath.
Mm-hmm.
So Herodias is most often held responsible, but I mean, I think she bears some responsibility, but in this scene, she does little more than answer her daughter's question.
Right.
And she doesn't do it with a command.
Mm-hmm.
She doesn't even do it with a verb. So she might find the most satisfaction in it. Mm-hmm. She might have the most to gain from it. But she doesn't really have any power in the outcome of the oath, and how she reacts to it isn't mentioned in this text at all. But Herod's dinner guests, these elite of Galilee who were sitting silently, they ensure that Herod fulfills his word. And like I said before, I think they're like that 2,000 wills. They're pressing Herod forward. He's going to have to kill this elephant, mm-hmm. even though the elephant's not a problem.
Right.
And I think they exercise an enormous amount of power by their presence there. So just as a little quick wrap-up point here, John's beheading, I think, further emphasizes this theme of honor and shame. So Donahue and Harrington, a couple of other biblical scholars, note that beheading is parallel to crucifixion. It's a type of execution that was designed to defame the person so treated. And while Herod might find honor in this execution, John is shamed in the sight of the PCR judging Herod.
Hmm.
So it's one of those things like, for somebody to be honored, somebody is to be shamed,
mm-hmm.
That we talked about earlier. But John's beheading is it's sort of his unmanning. I mean, and shaming has a lot to do with masculinity and where you fall on that scale. And I'm sure that as time goes on, we'll talk a lot more about that stuff. It's too big to crack open now. But this shaming of John, it's really not the final word for him in the story. And I think that's how Mark sort of ties this up, is that there's this whole system of honor and shame that's happening with Herod, his guests, and the daughter and the mother. And they're all fighting for this power over what's going to be the honorable outcome here, I think. But for John, he's got a different public court of reputation. So what's honorable for his PCR is to take up his corpse and lay it in a tomb. Proper burial was a sign of honor and divine favor. And John is therefore honored in his death. So by his own PCR, the shame given him by the elites of Galilee isn't relevant, because the honor of his own disciples in giving him a proper burial kind of restores him to an honorable position within that particular community. So I think that's an important thing to note too, is that, I mean, to an extent, big picture kind of stuff, the PCR of John the Baptist is irrelevant, because Herod's still going to do what Herod's going to do, regardless of whether these,
right.
you know, followers of John think he's an honorable person or not. So to that extent, I mean, John stays shamed, but noting that in these smaller circles, there are negotiations of that power, and so that's John the Baptist's death.
Beheading.
By beheading and unmanning. So, any final thoughts?
It's just fascinating how I think, obviously, we have jockeying of power in our world today. I mean, that's just something that's always been around and will be around. But I think it's just fascinating to take, you know, a small section of the New Testament and just have a window into how power struggles happened in antiquity, and how it isn't. I think a lot of times we look at power struggles and we think of things maybe unilaterally, like it's really something happening overwhelmingly from one person or something, or it's this person's fault or that person's fault, but this story is a really nice example of how power is, it branches out and it's fractured, and different people have different roles to play, mm-hmm. in that it wasn't just one person that actually led to the death of John the Baptist. It was a whole group of people, yeah. for maybe reasons that they, you know, none of them really actually, except for maybe Herodias, who kind of instigated it, maybe, mm-hmm. but the forces and system that played it out was actually through a bunch of really kind of complicated interactions. It's a nice window into seeing how that happens and how violence can happen as a result of that. Whereas, again, I think it's, for me anyway, in the context and conversations I've been part of, I think it's really easy to be like, it's so-and-so's fault, they did this mm-hmm. thing. And that's not to say that that doesn't happen,
yeah.
but story is usually more complicated yeah. underneath. So,
well, I mean, I think it's, some of it is those who stand to benefit from the one person who we want to hold responsible mm-hmm, to, mm-hmm. or so those who stand to benefit and those who have the power to stop or support those people, I mean, are just as important. And so I think, let's just take the quintessential example of Nazi Germany. Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah, Hitler was a real bad dude, but he didn't get there by himself.
Exactly.
And he didn't pull off what he pulled off alone.
Mm-hmm.
There were active participants in that. There mm-hmm. were people who said, give me the head on a plate, like Herodias,
right.
who did the dancing like the daughter. And then there were also those who just sat in the room and let it happen, like every average citizen who turned a blind eye to the evil that they were seeing.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think one of the things that we can learn from this passage is that, no, maybe we're not the Herods or the Herodias, but we are often the dinner guests mm-hmm. in the room. And
yeah.
we are often the people, we are often the PCR. We're the public court of reputation who can decide what is honorable and what is not. And in our particular society, the ballot box is a great place to do that. But mm-hmm. also, I mean, in your local churches, in your school groups, we're all parts of various different kinds of PCRs. And the idea that to sit back and do nothing is tantamount to doing something to support mm-hmm. the bad thing you don't want to see happening. It is a true statement. Granted, there definitely are times that your hands are tied and there's really not anything you can do about
sure.
a particular atrocity. But recognizing that there are also multiple occasions where you do have the voice to... you could either be one of the soldiers saving Jonathan's lives, or you can be one of the dinner guests letting John the Baptist
mm-hmm,
get
mm-hmm.
killed, all because some douchebag in power said something stupid.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And let's just be honest. That's every leader in the world. There's no shortage of douchebags in power saying something stupid. I think this passage is really, really critical. I think how I read it maybe doesn't preach well. But again, this is not your grandma's Bible study, and we are not teaching you how to be a pastor. So we're just, you know, trying to take these texts seriously and doing it from a position of been trained with the techniques and the research. Well, just the access to... scholarly stuff to really take these passages on.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, I hope if you listened all the way to this point that you enjoyed it. This particular episode has been brought to you by the Holy Spirit.
Sponsored
by the Holy Spirit. We don't have a sponsor. The Holy Spirit wants nothing to do with this. Yeah, so we have an email. It's called notyourgrandmapodcast@gmail.com. So if you hate us, don't use that. But if you like us or have constructive criticism or passages you want us to discuss,
yeah, especially
or
if you want to hear something, yeah.
Methods that you'd be interested in hearing about, let us know and we'll do our best. So that's all I have.
Until next time.
Or maybe this is the last time. Who knows? Apocalypse now. Bye.